Up till 1998, Indonesia used to be governed by what was called the New Order regime of President Suharto. Suharto was president for over 32 years. It was in theory, it was a democracy. In practice, it was kind of a benevolent dictatorship, you could say, relatively benevolent. 1998 onwards, a bit before the Asian crisis hit the area, more and more criticism regarding Suharto's type of governance had place, and in the end this ended in his resignation as president due to huge and massive popular protest. But I should point out actually how the new order worked. I put that in a kind of pyramid over there. It's often said that actually new order was a kind of patrimonialistic system, which generally it was. The country was run by the president, family and his cronies. They were, well, top of the top. If you were a little closer to them with lots of influence, you were in the middle, cadre, higher level government officials, say heads of departments, major civil servants, heads of provinces. Beneath that, you would have other people in government, in business, military, and they're not here, but beneath that you would have, well, you could say huge deserts or small grains of sand of being the general population supporting the pyramid. It also had a consequence that if you wanted to have a career in the civil servants, in the civil administration, in the army, in anything that had to do with official governance, you needed to be part of the system, whether you liked it or not. That had as one major effect that by the time that Suharto and his regime were overthrown, the people at the top, well, were clearly and officially put out of their positions, but all the other people beneath it weren't. And even so, if you wanted to have change, you would still need to incorporate these people, because simply there were no other people who had the skills, who had the experience, or who were able to fill the functions these people were filling at the time. Now, when Reformasi happened, the centralized system was overthrown, and it was changed for a decentralized system. This happened through two laws, which came out in 1999. They were rather interesting. What happened was that lots of administrative authority was decentralized from the central level, bypassing the provincial level to the level of the district, which is a level, an administrative level beneath the province. And to give you some idea, at present there are about 400 districts in Indonesia. Each of these districts has a district head and has a district parliament who govern the district. The laws told them what their authorities were. Or actually, to be more sure, they told them what their authorities were not, because they did not define what the actual authorities were. They told them they could not have their own army, they could not have their own foreign relations, they could not start new religions or have a special take on existing religions, so rather quite general things. But that's about it. It did not tell them anything or very much on how to run the districts individually. So that resulted in an enormous amount of local legal regulations, highly, highly diverse, which completely overpowered the central level, which was supposed to check on these things. So all of a sudden, from a country that used to be very strongly, very centrally organized, it was rather deorganized into lots of central, decentral, local districts, largely operating themselves. 2004, because by then the district heads and the district's parliament became subject to direct elections by the population of the district. Before that, they were appointed by the central government. Now, all of a sudden, they were actually tied to the districts which they were governing by through these direct elections. So what you get was, well, pretty strong autonomy, basically. But as these things go, people didn't go quietly, didn't go easily. People who had been in the new order structure, who had a position of power within the districts, usually kind of tended to cling on to this, to the position which they had. Other people who were known to this system of governance, just imagine the country had been ruled in this way for 32 years, so a rather large part of the population didn't know any other system of administration and tried to copy it. So observers were afraid that actually what would happen was that all these districts would be turned into areas ruled by little Suharto, who pretty much did whatever they liked to do in the area. To a certain extent, that's what happened. To another extent, it wasn't, because following the same model, competitors came up to that pretty briefly. But in general, what people said after the first 2-3 years is that, well, actually, we were hoping to have a massive réformation, an era of great, huge reforms that didn't really come about. What we're having is a massive transition, a transition era. Well, basically, in politics, in law, in justice, I'll come to justice in a second. And so that's just as a bit of background. Now, this is kind of the subplot that runs through this story. I'm talking about land in Indonesia, as the title suggests. This is very much part of the entire justice idea in Indonesia, because Indonesia largely is an agrarian society. About 65 to 70% of the population depends on access to land for their daily sustenance. There's one law, in theory, that governs access to land. That's the basic agrarian law, the thing over there. It was designated in the 60s as the one law that should govern all access over land in all of Indonesia. However, it was designated before Suharto came to power, and it was seen at the time as a law that was rather communist-inspired. Indonesia had the third largest communist party in the world at the time. A couple of years after the law came into force, there was a change of regime. The communist party was, well, literally completely killed. Anywhere between tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of people, and communism from then on was illegal, literally. The law, however, you can't take out the law and just do away with it. So what happened was that a couple of laws of similar force were promulgated, which all in one way or the other pertain to land. For instance, the basic law on oil and natural gas refers to land in which you have oil or gas. Basic mining law, same thing, but then with coal, stuff like that. Basic forestry law refers to land on which forest is growing, and so on. So you have this basic agrarian law, and basically that refers to all the land that is not subjected to any of these other laws. That's very little. To give you some idea, don't mind, by the way, that Borneo is green. I'm not quite sure why it is, but it is. This, as a map of Indonesia, shows you the place. The basic forestry law at present governs about 70% of the entire territory of Indonesia, which means that the other 30% are more or less subject to the basic agrarian law. There's very little. It has serious consequences, because the basic agrarian law defines rights which people have to land. And actually, the only area where it's been recently thoroughly implemented and where land rights have been registered is in Java, in this island. All of the rest, it's not that functional as yet. One very important thing with the basic agrarian law is that it contains a kind of recognition of customary land rights, traditional land rights if you want, whereas the forestry law does not. People largely in these areas, in Kalimantan, Sulawesi, all refer to customary land rights when they claim their land. They don't refer to the basic agrarian law, which they don't know. But as you can imagine, quite a lot of these people are actually living in what's deemed forest land. So they are claiming rights which are, according to the law, non-existent. For years and years and years, this has been seen as something that is highly unjust, of course. But it was kind of a workable situation. I put it in a kind of figure like this. You had a population, you had land, you had government. Population and government were usually referring to the same land, but in many areas, Kalimantan, Sulawesi, population was rather sparse, huge tracts of lands were available. This meant that the population were pretty much able to manage the land which they claimed as being theirs without too much government interference. Unless one fine day there would be a mining company coming down or a logging company coming down, in which case they did not have much choice than just pack up and move somewhere else, something like that. But as you can imagine, people experienced that as being extremely unjust. They had been managing the land for generations in a specific way according to their own local system. had no idea that the government didn't recognize that from the time. They're sort of peasants, they're not people who have any law. So all of a sudden, when it comes down, it's seen as something that's not very nice. And actually, it's a system, just by way of illustration, that works pretty well. This is just a very small meeting of people regulating land affairs according to their local tradition. Usually it works like this. People meet on the porch in the evening. The guy sitting over there with the mustache is the local customary head. The other two people came up and said, well, we wanted to do something with that plot of land, is that okay? And he acts a bit like, well, he knows the rules more or less, but he's also the person who is supposed to remind who is using which land. So he's going to say, like, well, somebody else claiming that land, no other thing. So, well, yeah, go ahead and have fun with it. And of course, that refers to these kinds of circumstances. So rather out of the way, not the middle of some big metropolitan city, just small villages, out in the forest, out in the agrarian backlands, but there literally are thousands, ten thousands of these kinds of villages working in this way. Now, what happened after the decentralization laws came about was that, whereas before I had this scheme of three symbols, as you see, there are rather a lot more by now. You still have the local population, you still have land. But now, as local population, if you want to claim that land, there are several ways in which you can go about it. Before, I had lumped the elite regional government, judiciary, central government, all together as being government, which they pretty much were. Now that this huge central system has fallen apart, these groups have set themselves apart as well. There is competition between regional government leaders and central government representatives. There's competition between the judiciary and between the regional government. They're not necessarily cooperating. They can take different sides in different ways in which they look at things. Elite, I put them here because these can be government people, but they can also be people, for instance, traditional leaders. If you have a district with, say, a population of 40% of one ethnic group, and people manage to organize themselves in that way, well, then you suddenly have a new elite that is there that can confront and discuss matters with regional government and the judiciary. And since regional government is subject to direct elections, they are likely to enter into a discussion. For instance, one area where I worked quite a bit until 4 years ago, the judiciary was left out of everything that pertained to land, simply because people would discuss things directly with the regional government, as the judiciary would not. Well, they worked correctly. They defined that nearly all of the district was forest land, and that hence no traditional rights were could be applied. Regional government, thinking about votes, thought, well, better that we do, actually. And now the head of the local court of law has been replaced by someone who actually thinks that you should pay attention to customary rights. Another group that came about is social organizations. I put them over there. Before, it was quite impossible in Indonesia to start any kind of social organization that was not directly like the government. Now you can pretty much do what you like. We want but, and that but basically is that social organizations are still constricted by law, in the sense that if you start one, you have to inform local government. Officially, they have to be approved by the central government, and if you do something that is not in accordance with the directions of government, then government may see fit to replace your board. But that's something that won't happen very quickly. And there's also a way around all of this, which again is custom. I just pointed out that elite has got a considerable or can make use of custom, or customary groups can put forward custom as kind of a wild card to capture the interests of regional government and judiciary. The same goes for social organizations. If, for instance, you have a social organization, you go, oh yes, I have this organization, but this is actually a customary council. It's not a government organization, it's not an NGO, so it is not subject to any of these laws, because in none of these laws, customary councils are mentioned. So we can operate autonomously. And that's something that happens quite a bit. Now the point is that people are having this transition, basically, or trying to have this transition from moving to centrally controlled access to land to locally controlled access to land. Before, land was something you had. if government or anybody else would happen to use it, so be it. It just happened. Now all of a sudden, people are able to have some sort of control in it, or they can attempt to influence it. Thing with that is not something that is coming about very easily. There's no clear commission that's working on these changes, although everyone in government will say, yes, it's very important that we change laws regarding to land, they should be more just, make land more accessible, and so on. But also within government, there's a lot of competition. There are groups, and within the population as well, there are groups that will agree to changes in land law. There are groups that will agree on certain conditions. Think, for instance, of a district in which a large ethnic group claims territory as being theirs by customary right, and then think of immigrants from, say, Java, other outlying islands, moving to that place, resettling there with government permission, who now see their government recognized right as something that's being threatened by this group claiming indigenous rights to the area. They're usually not too happy about it. Feel quite worried, actually. So a couple of things are going on that set this change into movement. There's basically a very law-based new legislation. I won't go into it. It's rather experimental, quite exciting as well. Regional legislation, a lot of that's going on, which basically says, well, in this region, this district, we've now decided that we'll recognize customary rights for this ethnic group. Other part of the group may be living in the next district, what they want to be there. Two districts further ahead, there may be another type of legislation. And as I said, customary law is a strong way of getting your interests with the government. Yeah, this is just one quick example. This is somewhere in the middle of a forest in East Kalimantan. The area is designated as a protection forest, which means that you can't do anything there, strictly speaking. But as it happened, there are also a couple of communities living in the forest. They were living there before the area was designated a protection forest, which was done by bureaucrats in Jakarta, who never visited the area. And also they were not informed that they were living in a protection forest until 12 years afterwards or something like that. So control wasn't that strict. Of course, they were not too happy with it. Complained to local government. Local government said, well, okay, it's a protection forest, you can't do anything there. But considering that we have certain autonomous powers these days, we give you permission to open up a field in the area for, say, 100 hectares, and it's up to you how you divide it and when you use it. And if you move it over time, that's all fine. That's something that we do directly. This is another, or this is actually an example of how things can also move along. This is, what you could say, this is kind of a local militia, a local ethnic force, a group of people, Dayak, in East Kalimantan, who quite strongly claim local rights to land in the area. Dayak had been quite known for a couple of five wars, you could actually say, in West and Central Kalimantan, in which they expelled Madurese immigrants from land which they claimed were there. A couple of thousand people were killed in that. Never happened in East Kalimantan, but the government of East Kalimantan, of course, is quite worried about it happening over there as well. So, if you have these organizations parading across your street as a government, you tend to talk to them, also because generally their message is, okay, we're here to protect Dayak interests, we're also here to protect the peace. We're not interested in fighting or driving people off, we're just interested in protecting Dayak rights. So government, could you please talk to you? But as you see, their image is not a very subtle one. So, in my title I use the word transfiguration, because in my idea one thing that's happening is that even if there's kind of a issue going on, it's all people changing heads, people changing the discourse that they're using to get their interests across, rather than actually trying for a real, pure transfiguration of land law. The BOM, basic agrarian law, as I just mentioned, is a law that is being reviewed at this time. It's been reviewed for the past 3 years, so it'll go very quick. The idea of human rights, which has been taken up by lots of groups claiming indigenous rights, is a very strong idea. It's been part of Indonesian legislation for some time now. But as you saw in the past slide, it's also been exploited for other things. Elections suddenly give people a lot of influence in what's going on. But it also means that powerful elite people in these districts are able to buy votes and maintain their position in that way. And of course, violence, or actually the threat of violence, which is something that also was quite often practiced under the New Order regime, is still very much there. It is no longer a government monopoly. Everyone who can organize a militia is now able to exert such threats. So, actually, I bring more problems than solutions, I think. That's the fun of the seminar. Important questions, they've been coming to the fore in the past today and also the past few days as well. Whose justice are we talking about and whose truth are we talking about? If we're talking about justice in the sense of national law in Indonesia, it's kind of problematic because it doesn't work that well. If you look at customary law, for certain people who need their land, it's quite acceptable to think that such agrarian communities need certain plots of land for their daily survival. But how far should you let that evolve? Are we talking about the food transition? Well, surprise, basically. We have to wait for several years to see what's going on. It might be, it might not be. Just one brief example. Corruption used to be fierce in the bureaucracy in Indonesia. It still is. There is an anti-corruption commission, which is supposed to deal with these things. It started 3 years ago. The first version of the commission was set after 3 months on accusations of corruption. Right now, some people, also high government officials, have been convicted for corruption, but it's piecemeal. Same goes with victims versus rights. You can speak of victims, of course. You can speak of people who have been removed from the land which they filled for quite some time. But does it mean that they have rights to return there, or that they have rights to remove other people who are using such land at this moment? Well, that is not all politics will be clear by now, so I won't go into that. The local. Quite important, this issue. We're talking about the nation, but what goes on is all on highly local, small levels. What does that mean? Can you bring about transition if you work on this level? And how are you going to do that if you approach this transition as a legal matter, as changing the law, which is, for instance, with the Corruption Commission, or with the change of the basic agrarian law, what people are trying to do? Improve the law, things will get better. Probably won't, unless you improve social situations as well. And I think, yeah, that will work.